final investigator I met with was Dr. Moshe Talpaz, and our discussion focused on mainly CML, although I also asked him about the myeloid disorder of the year, myelofibrosis. But we started with one of the key issues that's come up in CML in the last couple of years, selection of an upfront TKI.
So with the current situation, and as long as we don't have external pressures from financing organizations, such as insurance and such as other bodies that govern treatment, we should start every CML patient with a second-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor, specifically nilotinib or dasatinib. And as long as the cost differential between imatinib and these two new drugs is not big, and it isn't big at this point, there is no reason to start a patient today on imatinib. That may change eventually when imatinib becomes generic, so we can reshuffle this discussion and come up with a discussion that we will be forced to have based on financial grounds. The outcome endpoints or milestones that have been defined are driven primarily by the results with imatinib, and they may have to be modified because apparently the new drugs are a little bit more efficient and get the results quicker. Nevertheless, our expectations are that by 3 months, a patient will at least have complete hematologic remission, the counts will be normal, as well as a minor cytogenetic response. Once a patient meets those criteria, this is meeting what we call ELN, or the European Leukemia Network criteria, and they are a good set of criteria that are very likely to be adopted by the NCCN as well.
So would you like to take a crack at discussing how you might choose, or oncologists in practice would choose, between nilotinib and dasatinib?
Yeah, this obviously, as one who is quote-unquote an opinion leader in the field, I'm being pressed by both to choose one. But the reality is the following. Two drugs were studied in large phase 3 studies. One is the ANEST-ND, the other one is the DECISION. And they are not matching studies. They are not identical studies. And to compare the results and say mine is better based on this study compared to the other one is somewhat unfair. Companies usually have reservation of studying head-to-head comparison between drugs, and they don't do it here either. So with all of these reservations, that, and I don't know the details, but my assumption is the following, that ANEST-ND, the Novartis study, was done earlier. They had better opportunity to choose good sites who are highly experienced with CML, and they generated a highly meticulous, extremely organized study. My concern with the decision, it came in later and maybe had to compromise and go to East European countries. And maybe some of the patients in East European countries have chronic phase CML, but much more neglected CML and much more advanced. So the populations are not necessarily comparable. That's why I'm refraining from comparing study to study. With all of that said, the results of ANEST-ND are somewhat superior, primarily in one aspect. And that aspect is the rate of progression at 1 and 2 years on nilotinib compared to imatinib. The rate of progression was about 6% on imatinib if we include clonal evolution. The rate of progression on the 300 milligrams twice daily of nilotinib was only 0.7%. In the decision study, there was no difference in the rate of progression by 1 year. By 2 years, and I have the figures, the rate, there start to be a bifurcation, and the rate of progression on imatinib is higher than the one on dasatinib. So while there are some dissimilarities, there are a lot of similarities. The rate of complete cytogenetic remission is equal between the two studies. The rate of molecular responses is not dramatically different. So overall, it may well be that the differences will lie with toxicity choices rather than activity, and it will depend to a large degree on the patients that we are getting to treatment. If it's a newly diagnosed patient with lung disease, I would choose nilotinib. If it's a patient with a pancreatic disease, liver disease, I would choose dasatinib. So if it's a patient with tremendous fluid retention, I would choose nilotinib, which doesn't cause fluid retention at all. And if it's a patient with history of migraine, I would not choose dasatinib because it can activate migraine. So I would make the decision basically not on activity, but on how the patient will live with the drug.
From a practical perspective, what about the issue of twice-a-day dosing with nilotinib versus once-a-day with dasatinib? Is that a practical issue?
I would be concerned with this issue, particularly in one subset, and that's young individuals with CML. What I noticed in my practice, I have in practice a good number of teenagers or college students, and not surprisingly, they don't want to remember that they have a disease, and don't want to feel sick, and don't want to see the doctor, and tend also to miss on the pills. And for them, once a day, take and forget, and not associated with any special hoopla as far as fasting and so forth, is easier than taking it twice a day with a certain arrangement, fasting 2 hours before, 1 hour after each time. So it may create a small difference. But that's theoretical. Have I encountered it in the real world? No, because this patient simply did not end up as a subset that gets nilotinib compared to a subset that gets dasatinib.
So I have a toxicity evaluation that's not from a clinical trial, but just more from an education perspective, where I kind of ask people who've had a lot of experience seeing a lot more patients than people in practice, sort of globally, you know, in terms of the fraction of patients who, quote, cruise through therapy, it's like they're taking Tylenol or something. Do you think there's a difference between imatinib and these two second-generation agents in terms of just quality of life and how people feel, or are they pretty much all the same?
No, there is clearly a difference, but it's not unidirectional. You cannot score it and saying, well, you cannot create a vector and say the new drugs have less toxicity, imatinib has more toxicity. It's really complex, and you'll get amplitudes depending on the toxicities that you choose. And there are some toxicities that are easier with imatinib and patients swear by the imatinib, and some that are clearly easier with nilotinib or dasatinib. And it turns out that there is some interaction between the patient's body and the drug, and that's not surprising, and that varies from patient to patient, from the patient that doesn't have a shred of a side effect to the patient that cannot take more than 200 milligrams of nilotinib and has also a very good response. So it is a broad spectrum.
So you mentioned the pleural effusion seen with the dasatinib. Could you talk about your understanding of the pathophysiology of how this happens, how you diagnose it and manage it?
Okay, I am very aware of this side effect because it's the dominant and most important side effect that relates to the dasatinib. That the standard doses of treatment is probably around 10%, whereas what is perceived as severe pleural effusion is about 2%, maybe a little more, because I don't accept the notion that having a significant pleural effusion can still be defined as moderate toxicity. Any significant pleural effusion is, for me, severe toxicity. Now, the etiology, in the past, I suspected that the etiology is similar to that of imatinib, which means inhibition of platelet-derived growth factor receptors alpha and beta, which the dasatinib inhibits as well, and as a consequence, capillary leakage. It seems that the story here is a little different. The patient with the dasatinib do not have the typical edema that patient with imatinib have. They don't have the truncal edema, facial edema, periorbital edema at all. But they have these pleural effusions and at times pericardial effusion, and at times it also denigrates into a pulmonary syndrome with pulmonary infiltrates and pulmonary hypertension. It seems to me that the work, I think primarily from Finland, which demonstrates that dasatinib is a strong activator of specific elements of the immune system by inhibiting SAR kinase family and as a consequence inhibiting regulatory T cells and stimulating NK cells, appears to play a major role here, and the reaction may be more inflammatory than leakage.
So have biopsies been done? And I mean, I'm sure they have, and do they show inflammation? Like, it's like a pneumonitis, are you saying?
That's what I suspect in some patients. But you know what? I haven't paid attention enough to see if the fluid, the pleural effusion fluid, is an exudate. I suspect it is, but I have not paid attention enough to see it and to look at it and to see what kind of effusion. But there is no question that there is pneumonitis-like situation. I've seen patients with pulmonary infiltrate, migratory pulmonary infiltrate, and it looked like pneumonitis.
And what exactly do you do treatment-wise, and what do you do in terms of the dasatinib when this happens?
Okay, so my personal attitude and what others are doing. My personal approach to it, because we have so many choices, because I also have experimental drugs, which are highly effective, is it's a no-no. It happens, the patient is off study and off the drug. Others, in the absence of other drugs at the time, tried steroids with diuretics, and it has some effect. But I am concerned with the risk of progression of some of this situation to pulmonary fibrosis and to more serious pulmonary hypertension, and I'm not willing to take the risk. And for me, that happens. Let's look for other drugs.
Okay, let's try a quick primer on monitoring of CML over time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious exactly, again, I know this has been debated a lot in the NCCN, exactly how you approach it, and do you see things being done in practice that maybe shouldn't be done?
It is a complex issue which is not simply to do with the practices. So let's go through examples and discuss it. Let's say that we have a patient, and as I've said, at 3 months we are expecting hematologic remission. At that point, the tools that we use are standard hematologic screen, and I also use FISH, fluorescent in situ hybridization, provided it's dual FISH, to see if the patient is already having some degree of cytogenetic response. The ELN is recommending a bone marrow, but I think you should try to get away from unnecessary bone marrow testing because it's too much at 3 months. At 6 months, if a patient is already by FISH in complete cytogenetic remission, and that's, by the way, one of the expectations, at 6 months, the patient is expected to have at least a partial cytogenetic response. And at that point, I start to move to testing with PCR. Peripheral blood polymerase chain reaction, and it should be emphasized it's quantitative PCR. So while we have less problems with FISH, as long as we work with a credible lab that is doing dual FISH and doesn't give us a report that says up to 5% can be false negative or positive, but it's only 1%, then we have a credible test that can deal with complete cytogenetic remission. However, once we get to complete cytogenetic remission, I'm moving to quantitative PCR. And here we have a very complicated, unsettled territory. There is the guidelines that came out from the CML working group, which suggested standardization against a standard of K562 cells.
Is that the international scale thing?
That's the international scale.
Okay.
And they qualify the responses by log reduction, and log reduction for them matches with reduction of the disease to levels of less than 1%, less than 0.1%, and so forth. Less than 0.1% is considered major molecular response, whereas less than 1%, I assume, is minor molecular response. The problem with this assay is that very few laboratories have incorporated it. And I don't know, well, I work with my own hospital lab and we discussed it constantly, so we can say that our results are fairly reliable. But as far as worldwide, it looks to me like one big chaos. I don't know what the results represent, what they are compared to, what is the standard, what are the ratios, and I hope that this issue will be put to rest. It's not a difficult issue, but it requires some work of standardization. And granted that the practitioners don't know about all of these nuances, so they relate to 0.1% as a major molecular response without knowing what the control is. To me, we were trying to deal with this issue because it clearly is an impediment to moving completely to PCR. PCR is a relatively simple assay. It's highly reproducible, can be done in the blood, but oh, by the way, some doctors still do qualitative PCR. They don't do quantitative at all. So you get a response. The patient still is positive. What do you do with that? So it's a slow transition to accept it and to learn it.
Yeah, I always try to look for ways to simplify things because, you know, people are just so inundated by information. I mean, if you have a laboratory, and I've seen this in lab tests, that says on their result, this was standardized according to the international scale. Is that, you like feel okay now that's the right lab, or that doesn't, you don't even know there?
Yeah, well, you need quality control. You need quality control. You need an FDA mandated effort to see what the heck is going on.
Another simple question, what exactly would you say is the specific major goal of treatment? Major molecular response, complete cytogenetic response, both, what?
So you're asking a question that is in the center of some debate among the experts of CML. The data that we have reviewed and relate to the study called IRIS, which is the first study for frontline patients with imatinib, this data suggests that patients who achieve complete cytogenetic remission with major molecular response do the best, with virtually minimal, if any, risk of progression. The patients that achieved complete cytogenetic response with minor molecular response, the greater than 0.1%, have a slightly, very, very slightly higher risk of progression. Others have repeatedly argued that that difference is so small, if at all, that the endpoint of complete cytogenetic response is good enough and there is no reason to go and get a deeper molecular response because the differential is minimal. I personally disagree because we are dealing now with treatment that may sustain the patient the next 50 years. And differences may become relevant much later rather than now.
So does that mean that you might consider switching therapy if a patient is not in major molecular response?
In my book, yes. Would everyone agree to it? I have my doubts at this day because we have seen the MD Anderson group challenges the notion that major molecular response patients do better than patients with complete cytogenetic response and minor molecular response. So that's an issue that has to be settled. In a recent work by Tim Hughes from Australia, he argues that there may be not a big difference as far as risk of progression, but there is a difference in risk of resistance, which is more common in patients who do not have a deep molecular response. So instinctively, I believe the deep molecular response has an advantage because subtle differences may emerge later on as risk of resistance 10, 20 years down the road. Another reason why I prefer deep molecular responses is they can serve as the platform going towards the cure, which we don't have at this point. At this point, we created a scenario of living with the disease and not a cure.
There is one more CML question I really want to ask you. We actually did a survey of 25 oncologists recently and asked them, what fraction of patients who are receiving a TKI for CML have a problem with adherence, a clinically significant problem? I'm curious how you would answer that question. Is this like really not a problem at all? People know they've got to take their medicine or they're not going to survive, or is it a problem and how often do you see it?
Okay, so obviously it's not a scientific answer. It will be an answer of what I feel. Based on what the patient tell me, there is 90% adherence. That's what they tell me. What I think is happening is more like 60 to 70% adherence.
Wow.
There are patients that have stomach irritations with imatinib and clearly will skip it. There are those that have very unpleasant diarrhea with imatinib, they will skip. With the issue of the complex administration of nilotinib, I'm sure that there are patients that will miss morning, evening, will wish to eat and so forth. Or if a patient with dasatinib had headaches, he will skip it. The compliance will be inferior in young individuals who have to think about work and other things, college. It will be much better in older patients.
Any sense? I mean, there have been some attempts to try to look at this, but of course, it's really impossible to get the perfect data about how much adherence problem you have to begin to threaten the ability to stay in remission.
Well, I'm doing it the following because I have no other way to do it. If I see a worsening of a result of a test, I'm asking the patients, do you take the drugs? If the patient swears by it and in the next visit nothing has changed, I tend to believe him. But in young guys, I don't ask them. I tell them, I bet you didn't take the drug. That's why your result is much better and you're putting yourself at danger. And that was proven each time. Each time they had to accept it, they took the drug and things got much better. So there is no question that in young patients, many of the cases of inadequate response relate to compliance. But my general attitude toward this question is the following. I don't care how you get there. If you get to the level of response that I'm satisfied with, fine. Then I don't care. I can tell you I have patients that respond to 50 milligrams of dasatinib and have a complete molecular remission. And I have a patient that is treated with 200 milligrams of nilotinib with a superb remission. And that is my choice because there were compromising medical reasons. So I think that we follow a certain dogma that was generated in clinical studies. But actually, the human body allows tremendous variability. And we should go by the result, not by the amount of drug.
Interesting. Do you have any sense? I mean, for example, you know, if somebody were to miss 3 days of treatment in a month, that'd be about a 90% taking the pills. Any sense about how many sort of pills chronically you have to miss a month before maybe it makes sense pharmacologically or something that you'd have a problem?
No, because we have not analyzed it. Generally, I think that missing 2 or 3 days a month is a trivial issue. But who knows? We haven't analyzed it systematically because the patient will not give us accurate information. So this is an important question. It's very possible that in the majority of the patient, the dose that we give covers plus the situation. In other words, exceeds the needed dose. That is probably particularly true when it comes to dasatinib. In these patients, the responses, the drug is so powerful, they may not need the 100 milligrams daily. But that study was not studied systematically. We all generate data from phase 1, phase 2, and we conclude this is the dose a patient should take. And we don't do the nuanced type study to see, well, could it be that smaller doses will do as well?
Okay, let's close out by talking about the new and exciting biology of myelofibrosis. Maybe you can just sort of capsulize it. I have Dr. Mesa's on the same program you're on. So rather than go through every detail, I mean, I know you were involved with the COMFORT effort. I'm just kind of curious of your macro perspective on the biology of this disease and how you've seen it evolve and these exciting new developments in treatment.
First, it's been an orphan disease for so many years. You know, nothing, absolutely nothing was going on. And I remember still from the 70s, a paper on splenectomizing the patient. You splenectomize and they report, oh, there is a remission for a few months, the liver gets bigger. And the patient progresses as if nothing has been done. It was very, very frustrating. And all the drugs that were available had low-level, minuscule effect, starting with androgenic steroids, erythropoietins, interferon, IMiDs a little better. But the overall feeling was it was a very serious, debilitating, devastating condition that leads steadily towards the demise of the patient. So the fact that a mutation has been discovered in at least half of the patients with myelofibrosis and much more than half of the patients with polycythemia was of great interest because the notion was we will come up with a drug because this is a kinase. And not long after the mutation was discovered, drugs which inhibit the kinase domain of JAK2 have been discovered.
Can you talk a little bit about the biology of JAK2, what it actually is?
Yes. JAK2 is a tyrosine kinase which links between the external world and the internal world of the cell. It is part of the complex of many of the growth factor receptors. Growth factors have an external site outside the cell and an internal site, an internal domain. And once a growth factor binds to its cognate ligand, it gets activated, it gets phosphorylated, transphosphorylates the JAK2, which also in turn phosphorylates the receptor itself. They create a complex. And to this complex, several proteins are mobilized, known primarily as the STATs. The STAT protein is a protein that once phosphorylated creates dimers, dimerizes. It means one molecule joins to another one because it's now phosphorylated, and together with the change of its structure and polarization can now move through the nuclear membrane, get into the nucleus, and become a transcription factor. So this directly links the outside of the world from the ligand all the way to the nucleus and changing signal. And the effect is primarily proliferative in nature. And many, many growth factors utilize JAK2. You can say that erythropoietin, growth hormone, IL-6, and many, many others are utilizing JAK2 as part of their cascade of activation. So JAK2 is, well, by the way, we have to talk about JAKs, not necessarily JAK2. There is also JAK1 and JAK3. JAK3 shares some similar activity. It's also involved in activation cascades. of the immune system, whereas JAK1 plays an important role in interferon pathways.
Could I just ask, you know, I'm kind of curious when you mention how critical this pathway and these receptor or these factors are, just sort of, we'll talk about it, you know, what's been seen clinically, but any explanation for why the JAK2 TKIs haven't been more toxic? Are there like pathways that go around these critical things?
It's a very good question. In other words, there has to be in the cell tremendous amount of serendipity and bypassing and loops, because otherwise, please explain to me a totally different, I'll counter with a different example. How come the dasatinib inhibits 1/3 of the whole human tyrosine kinome? It inhibits 1/3 of all the tyrosine kinases.
Really?
Yes. And it doesn't do, the effect is clearly, you don't see a devastating effect.
So it's like not specific at all?
No, it's not specific. It inhibits many, many things.
Wow.
Yet when we try to take it into other cancers, its activity seems to be fairly restricted to CML and not in other cancers where SARC is activated and so forth. Probably because the others are not that relevant in cancer.
Wow.
But the fact is that the body or the cell knows how to adjust and how to accommodate certain stimuli and certain noxious stimuli.
So maybe with that comment in terms of some of the biology, again, we could talk about that for the next hour, but maybe you could just sort of fast forward to the clinical data that we have from these two amazing trials, COMFORT 1 and COMFORT 2.
Well, first, we know that JAK2 is mutated in many cases of myelofibrosis. We know that also another gene called MIPL is involved, and maybe other genes involved as well. We don't know that JAK2 is the cause of the myeloproliferative disorders. Other genes like TET2 and others have been involved. And the story is not fully clarified at this point. But there is clearly that JAK2 is involved in the proliferative signal and signaling in this disease. One of the major things with myelofibrosis is the increased proliferation that leads to splenomegaly, high white count, sometimes elevated platelets. And shutting off JAK2 seems to interfere nicely with the proliferative cascade in the disease. So it may be a symptomatic relief, but what a symptomatic relief.
So just to pick up on that point, to clarify from my naive eyes, are you talking about the fact that, you know, one of the things that was discussed there at ASCO was this issue of cytokine-mediated problems, as opposed to, I guess, what, some kind of neoplastic cell infiltration? And for example, where does a splenomegaly fit into that clinical picture?
Well, there is the argument, and I think it's primarily by Ayalu Teferi, that JAK2 is pivotal in this cytokine storm, if you wish, because there are many cytokines released that creates the B symptoms and the patients being very symptomatic with weight loss and so forth. And it seems that shutting off that pathway is very effective in inhibiting many of these cytokines that are produced, released, and cause symptoms. So one thing that we see very quickly with JAK2 inhibitors is improvement in symptomatology. It clearly, unquestionably is anti-proliferative as well. Because if you look at patients with high white count and myelofibrosis, the white count normalizes. If you look at patients with high platelets, they go down. Anemia gets a little worse because of this myelosuppressive effect. So it's clearly anti-proliferative. And as the consequence of anti-proliferative, we see fairly frequently reduction in the size of spleens.
So what's a typical scenario, or maybe there's even a patient on the COMFORT 1 trial that you can recall in terms of the time course? You start the therapy, when do you start seeing things change?
Well, I've seen a lot of varieties here. Keep in mind that I work not only with the COMFORT study, I worked also with another drug and with others as well. So the general information is that it's very variable. Most of the patients will respond as far as symptoms very quickly, within a week. They will feel better. And that's dramatic. The night sweats go away very quickly. The appetite improves and they start to put on muscle, although they wait, that takes more time. The reduction in the spleen size is relatively quick, weeks. It doesn't take a long time. So this is a quick effect. The question is, do all patients respond? The answer is no. And I don't think that we have done yet a multivariate analysis. We don't have thousands of patients to say there are parameters that will guide us to expect this patient will not respond, this will respond. We don't know what it is yet. We know that we have patients with very big spleens that did not respond, but we also know that there are patients with very big spleens that respond. So we have no idea what governs response or resistance. Maybe it's the duration of the disease. Maybe the spleen is already fibrotic. Maybe it is size. Maybe it is other parameters. After all, not all patients respond.
Well, you say that not all patients respond, but that waterfall plot, it looks like at least initially, almost everybody responds.
I think that overall it will end up with 2/3 of the patients having some response that shows the average reduction of the spleen. But as far as greater than 50% reduction or 1/3 in volume, that will not happen in all the patients, maybe in half of them. So it's not universal, clearly. So it will be worthwhile to figure out why. Now, perhaps the more important issue is the durability of the response.
Right.
So we thought, well, this will be a trivial effect. There will be rapid resistance. Will last 2 weeks. I now have patients that passed the 3 years. I have patients that are now going for 4 year plus and are totally, completely asymptomatic. They are not in complete remission because we can here and there see a few immature cells still spilling in the blood. We can do a bone marrow and it still has elements of fibrosis.
I think in Comfort 1, at least when they reported at ASCO, 80% of the patients were still on treatment.
Yeah, and that totally fits my personal experience. About 80% of my patients are still on treatment. Comfort 1 is an experience of 1 year. Mine is an experience of 3 years now.
So any predictions about when or if this agent is going to be available and what other agents like that are coming down the pike?
Okay, I assume that this one has moved forward to the FDA. So it's probably, I predict it's a few months away. The other agents, well, the bickering will start and I'll have to figure out that between the industrial bickering, what is real and what's not so real.
Yeah, well, let me know right away.
Yeah. So one of the bickering element is the following. The argument that inside drug is a pan inhibitor of all the JAKs. It inhibits JAKs 1, 2, and 3, and therefore it is more myelosuppressive and maybe more toxic. There are companies now that have a highly selective JAK2 inhibitor that doesn't inhibit JAK3 or JAK1, and they argue that they don't see myelosuppression at all. So that will be interesting. That's a plus. It's not a plus so much in activity, it's a plus in toxicity.
So I know you were very much involved with the development of imatinib in CML. And I'm curious, at least from a very global perspective, in terms of how these diseases are going to be managed, is myelofibrosis the new CML?
Myelofibrosis is very different. To start with, it's a better disease. Inherently, patients live better with it. So yes, absolutely, because we will go earlier and earlier. I don't see any reason why to go to severe myelofibrosis and why not to start with newly diagnosed myelofibrosis. I'd love to do it with essential thrombocythemia and polycythemia vera and see if we can cure those diseases. The problem there is not that the drugs are not active. They are extremely active. But can we deal with issues of very long survival? Because in these diseases, the outlook is excellent. So how can we sell such an approach to an FDA arguing, what do you want to treat patients that live 20, 30 years? And the argument will be, we can potentially cure them. We cannot do this in the more advanced disease.
So final question. In terms of, we were talking before about CML and the TKIs and side effects. What's been seen with this particular TKI against JAK2? I know there's an issue, I think, of myelosuppression, but also what about quality of life?
The overall impression, and I'm referring now to two drugs that I have used. I have used the Insight, which is one set of studies, and I have used also the Sanofi Aventis, formerly Targagen drug. The quality of life is excellent. Yes, we deal with myelosuppression, which requires dose reduction, dose interruption. That's not really a big factor in quality of life. Quality of life issues are diarrhea, fatigue, lack of energy, infections, and so forth. Those are uncommon. The quality of life overall is equal to better than what we have seen with imatinib. Granted, we are likely to see unique, rare toxicities, cardiac and others with time. So I don't want to generalize, not enough experiences there. We'll need thousands of patients before we summarize it. But the initial impression is that this is not chemotherapy, this is targeted therapy.
Yeah, when I asked you whether or not myelofibrosis is the new CML, I was thinking more globally in terms of sort of, you know, what this is going to mean to the patient and what their life is likely to be like. And, I kind of wonder whether it sounds like there might be a possibility of, you know, real improvements in quality of life, quantity of life, but also maybe long-term indefinite treatment.
I'm buying because I was always impressed that this is one of the more devastating diseases. It is. We talk about cancer being devastating, but here the patients, you can see them gradually losing weight, losing all their muscle tone, walking around with huge bellies and subsequently with liver disease, ascites, at times varices and bleeding from varices. It's absolutely awful. The end stage is absolutely a bad, bad disease. And starting to see that we can, I use the term freeze it, keep it in one place and prevent progression is a huge achievement that resembles the effect of imatinib in CML, if confirmed. However, as a biologist, I can never forget the fact that CML is a disease that progresses to acute leukemia in a predictable manner over a relatively short time, whereas the model of progression in myelofibrosis is occasionally progression to leukemia, but much more frequently a devastating effect on the body.